I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. Fly down that street on the chance that...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Call us toll-free anytime. It's 1-888-429-5471 if you'd like to join us.
By chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own.
Barbara Rodriguez with us is a child advocate and a crusader as the founder of The Celebrity Nanny. She used her 20-year experience of working as a nanny as a springboard to a career as a national speaker and an author. She's the author of The Organic Nanny's Guide to Raising Healthy Kids. And let us say, Barbara, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm honored. How exciting.
Thank you so much for being here. Barbara, when it really comes down to it, and we look at health today, and we look at what kids eat today, obviously, I'm sure you've run into this time and time and time again. There is such an obesity epidemic out there with these children, and nobody seems to be able to get a handle on it to get some kind of control. Where do you think it is that we're going wrong? And is it, does it start with the parents? Is it school? Where do we have to look at? Where do we take that first step to get the kids on the right road?
Wow. Yes, absolutely, Michael. Absolutely. I mean, at this point, we're dealing with skyrocketing rates of asthma, type 2 diabetes, obesity, autism, learning disabilities, and even cancers in children. And I've been, fortunately, I've gotten the opportunity not only just to study this and this be my passion, but I got to work for some of the most amazing people in my career as a nanny. I got to work for the rich and famous, and I got to see what celebrities have in their refrigerators, and I just started to see a connection, and I thought, well, if I could bring my passion, which is basically a message of prevention, and teaching parents how to do it a little bit better than was done with them, I could get their attention with, obviously, the high-profile families. And so it all came together, and I realized it was in alignment with a purpose, and it was very awesome to see children get well. And I'm also from a Cuban background, and my grandmother was a great healer. So I'm a third-generation healer, and she always brought her healing from the garden. And I have brought all that to this mission, which is basically a mission of prevention and saving childhoods.
Barbara, I see one of the biggest problems that we have today is we live in a very fast-paced, microwavable world. Everybody's in a hurry.
Right.
Nobody's got time for anything. Throw some food on the table. Just get them fed and get out of there. And I think that in and of itself has to be a problem that has to be dealt with. There's got to be that time to be able to feed them properly and at the same time take the time to sit down with them when you do it.
Absolutely. I think, unfortunately, parents are aware only when their children get sick. You know, unfortunately, we have to wait, even with adults, when cancer rates are skyrocket, all of a sudden we start paying attention. Well, what's in that fast food? It's fast, it's easy, and it's cheap, but is it going to cost me a lot more in other areas?
Sure.
So, absolutely, yeah, I agree with you.
No, we talk about organic, and by the way, if you and I sat down at the table to debate this, we would be on the same side of the table talking to everybody else, because I'm on your side with this.
And, Thank you. Awesome.
90% of how I eat what you're talking about here. And I think it's extremely important. But that's we talk about food. It's not just food. And I think there's where the message is. It's, you said it, the diabetes, the ADD, the heart problems, the hardening of the arteries. I mean, this list goes on. And if we're trying to save time and money, it's going to cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars or a life down the road if you don't address it today.
Absolutely. I also think teaching prevention, if parents just, they don't have the time. They don't know how. And they can't afford a high-profile nanny. They can't afford, you know, someone to come in. And I think it's the popularity of shows like Dr. Oz or, you know, these wonderful OWN network shows all of a sudden become very popular because they bring information to parents. And I think we all want to prevent getting ill. And certainly once you have a child, it all changes. You know, you figure, well, you'll make it through the next 40 years and you'll be okay. You know, the ozone layer or, you know, whatever toxins sure. are in your soda. But once you have a baby, it all changes. Then you're worried about another 80 years and even 80 years after that with your grandbabies.
See,
so
I think
it is about prevention.
Sure. And I think here's where the problem is. It's, you know, years ago when somebody said, go green, you got this picture of somebody sitting, you know, under a tree with something
right.
wrapped around their head going, you know, more colors, man, it's cool.
Yeah,
and that's not what green is today. And if you start talking organic, there was a definition of organic that's what people who sat under trees ate. And that's not so. You know, organic food today is getting more and more prevalent in society, and more
yes.
people are starting to get the idea that it's okay because these other things that they put into foods will literally kill you down the road if you don't know what you're eating.
Right. Oh, I agree. And I also want to say that we need to make organics a lot more affordable. And that's a big, huge point that Organic Nanny, my mission, my brand, it's crucial that we, you know, we make it available. A great example is Walmart and Target. You can now buy organic produce at Walmart with food stamps. And I think that's pretty cool. I think that's awesome. And that we're actually, if there's a little patch to grow a garden, you might grow a few herbs and start out that way. Or co-ops. I mean, there's a lot of options to where we, how we get our food and how we prepare it. And learn to cook, you know. Let's
See,
learn
and
what we like to eat. We got to learn to cook it.
Sure, and the real problem is not necessarily with government, with the schools. It's with the parents, what they send to the kids to school with, in the lunchbox, quote-unquote, because they're putting, you know, tons of, hundreds of millions of dollars into, you know, food in the schools. Well, that's all well and good, but the kids are still going to bring in the hamburger, the hot dog, the candy, the whatever. So
I think,
in essence,
I agree with you, Michael. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to teach the detox. I mean, how
yes.
do you just get off of this junk food generation that we're on, this, you know, McDonald's culture? Ideally, I would love to see every child start out with a clean, you know, vegetarian diet and choose foods. But unfortunately, we throw junk food at them. And it's quick and it's easy. And like you said before, it's what parents know. Because advertisers are spending enormous amounts of money to promote this. I think it's easier to get off crack at this point than it is junk food.
Sure.
They don't advertise that when you're driving down the road.
No, and go back to, you know, Coca-Cola. Way back when, Coca-Cola, the soda was addictive. Why? Because there was cocaine in it until the government
yeah.
finally stopped it.
It's the same thing
with different foods. There are also foods that are very addictive that people are not even aware that once they start, they have the craving for it. Your body is an electrochemical factory, and it when it gets something, a hold of something, and it gets used to it, it craves it and unconsciously moves you towards it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you just can't have one. You know, you can't stop at one. Okay, there's a reason the MSG is put in there. They want you to keep going. And then we're dealing with obesity rates where children, you know, are being bullied because they're overweight or because they don't look, you know, healthy. And I think
sure.
that's, this Organic Nanny is also a solution for bullying. I think we can do better.
We can
be taught.
We have baseball bats and clubs that come with it to protect from the bullies. I got it. But okay, seriously now, when we take a look at it, we started talking about this early on, but what about the when you don't have time to cook? What can a parent do in those rapid minutes where they've got to get in and out and still keep the child healthy?
Okay, I'm not an extremist, and I'm a realist, and I've been a nanny for 20 years, and I've worked with all types of different families, and I'll say there are different calibers of junk food. You don't have to go for the worst. You can sort of slowly phase kids out, and I'm on parent sides, and I know that it's hard when they're screaming for something, and they are addicted to it. It's very hard. But you start substituting with fruit and vegetables. You just start adding them in. You know, use up what you have, and then You know, mommies are the ones that are buying all of this. They're the ones making that choice in the stores. And you can choose to do better, and they will meet our demands. You know, organics will start showing up and at reasonable prices.
Now, by the way, a lot of the advertising that we see, such as, I see it all the time, it's the V8 vegetable juice with the antioxidants, all natural, yada, yada. My only concern is this, and I get it every once in a while if I don't get enough vegetables, but my only concern is this. You know, it says all natural, this and that and whatever, but then why will it last for 2 years in a bottle?
Yeah. Right, like the Happy Meal. They didn't do the experiment. Yeah. We do that as well. Now, why is it the cat won't even eat it? You know,
yeah.
It's like because the cat knows better. It's like it'll
That's
just
true.
Sniff at it. Yeah, I think there's so many preservatives, and they don't metabolize in the body either. They don't go through the system. So you see a lot of digestive issues and children getting sick. Maybe the first time they have it, they'll have junk food. That they'll have a clean diet the first 2 years of life, first three years, and then all of a sudden they'll taste it and they'll get sick. Or they'll have an allergic reaction.
But let me ask you a quick question with this, too. We pick up the book, and is there the Organic Nanny's Guide to Raising Healthy Kids? Are there recipes in the book?
Absolutely. There's amazing Cuban recipes, too, because Cuban food is very close to my heart, and it's what I grew up on. And, kids, it's what you put on the table, you know. At least they try, and if they see you eat well, they will learn to eat well. If they see you take shortcuts, then they're going to take shortcuts. So it's all an example. But definitely recipes, yes. I worked with Chef Gabrielle, who's one of my favorite human beings on earth, and we tried everything out. And I know that certain children have comfort foods and favorite foods, so we tried to sneak things in. So there's a lot of that type of recipes.
Yeah, and by the way, when it really comes down to it, and it's like anything else, because someone is a mom or a dad, and especially a mom in this particular case for the most part, doesn't mean that you know how to cook. It doesn't mean that you know what the most the healthiest thing is for that child. We model. What my mom was taught was by her mom, and her mom got taught by her mom, and it just, you know, it trickles down that way. And
exactly.
It's got to start at home, no matter which way we look at it.
Well, also, pay attention to your child. If there's behavioral issues, if you start to see things that just don't make sense, look at your food. What are you putting into the child? And what are you teaching them in general? I mean, the book is all about being compassionate. The whole message is a message of prevention and doing it better than it was done with us, you know, taking it one notch up. But food is absolutely the first step, because I really feel that if you see certain behavioral issues like sugar, dairy, you could be poisoning your child and not know it. You know, I mean, that sounds a bit dramatic, but it really is something you can eliminate from their diet and see a huge difference in tantrums or in behavior or even grades.
No, by the way, and Barbara, you're spot on with that. The one thing I want to touch on, we're starting to run out of time, but I think it's extremely important. There's that old analogy that if you're on a plane and there's a problem and there's one oxygen mask, you don't put it on the baby, you put it on yourself, because that baby can't help you as long as you've got it together. And one of the things that you talk about, which I think is extremely important, is the mama makeover. You know, if you can't take care of yourself, how are you going to take care of your family?
Absolutely. The book has a very strong message of empowering mamas. This is information, helping them. I'm on their side. You know, if they could bring me in and I could spend a week with them, how would I detox the kitchen? What could I bring to them? It's absolutely a mission of empowering, of prevention, and of teaching the wisdom I have. And it's very exciting. So thank you.
No, and by the way, And being a mama the way you get empowered is learning how to be one. Just because you're a woman and you have a baby does not mean you're a mama. You could be a mother, but you may not be a mama. And it's the same thing with a man. Because you're a man and a father does not mean that, quote unquote, you're a father. These are learned experiences. These are learned traits. We're out of time. Let me ask you this, Barbara. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, www.thecelebritynanny.com. Google Organic Nanny. We're out there.
Do it slow. Do it slow.
Oh, well, www.thecelebritynanny.com. And the OrganicNanny.com is also a brand. We're putting together workshops through Whole Foods to educate mommies.
Wonderful. Hey, Barbara, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it. And if
thank
it was too
you.
Fast for anybody,
it's an honor.
We've got it up on our website. You can always find her. Hey, thanks for being here.
Okay, thank you.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us toll-free, 1-888-429-5471. That's 1-888-429-5471. Renee Clemens with us. Dr. Renee Clemens is a licensed clinical professional counselor with a master's in counseling psychology since 2001 and a PhD in psychotherapy since 2004. She's also a basic divorce certified mediator since 1996 and an addiction supervisor since 2007. And she's been practicing in the helping industry since 1994. And we're going to talk about something very interesting that happens to a lot of people, and they're not quite sure how to deal with it. And if we learn how to deal with it, we could avoid a lot of problems. And it's how to treat dual diagnosis. Ron and I, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can I pronounce your first name properly?
I'm hearing an echo.
Oh, okay. Well, I tell you what, if there's a little bit of an echo, the engineer is probably right on it right now and can fix that. So bear with it for a second. It should go away, okay?
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay, Ronit, did I pronounce your first name right?
Ronit.
Ronit. Ah, okay. I'll never have it wrong again. Let's talk about dual diagnosis. So there's so many problems that people have. Where was it, with all of your professional experience, that you began to realize that this is, and not only is, can be a problem for those who are just not aware of how to get a proper diagnosis?
Well, actually, right from the beginning. I never planned to go into dual diagnosis, by the way. I fell into it. I got my internship at a correctional institution because I was the last one to apply. It was the only thing left. And I found out that most of the inmates who became my clients or my patients had dual diagnosis. Unfortunately, they were already in prison. So it became very clear that there was a problem.
Now, by the way, when we talk about dual diagnosis, most people think when you hear diagnosis, you could be talking about it could be anywhere from cancer to having a cold or whatever. But there's also a diagnosis when it comes to something emotional, something intellectual, something behavioral that most of us really aren't quite aware of. I think a great example of that would be kids that are diagnosed with ADD. It might have missed the diagnosis. They might have had the symptoms of, but not that. And they never get the real help that they need.
That is true. I don't go as far as to diagnose what happened in childhood, but what happened just before addiction. The reason a person gets into addiction is because there was some kind of undiagnosed problem. And that happened not necessarily in childhood, although it might have begun in childhood, but it was a pre-existing diagnosis to addiction.
Okay, now by the way, when we are dealing with all of the symptoms that we look at, we know our brain is a great big electrochemical factory, and more today in the world we are finding more and more about how that brain and how that brain chemistry affects us, good, bad, or indifferent. It's there. How much of that work have you done yourself?
Oh, very much. I discuss this in detail with my patients. I believe that knowledge is power. And when I give that knowledge or help the patient gain that knowledge, they are much more equipped to deal with whatever problems they have.
Okay, let's start with a definition, and then we can work our way from there. When we talk about dual diagnosis, what is that so we have something we can wrap our arms around and then move from there? So what is a dual diagnosis?
Dual diagnosis is a combination of at least two types of emotional difficulties, out of which one is substance abuse or addiction to drugs and or alcohol. The other diagnosis can be anything, any emotional difficulty. It can be trauma, it can be stress, it can be loss, emptiness, depression, codependency, anxiety, anger, and on and on and on.
Okay, so in essence, let me hear from, let me get if I'm hearing you right with this. When somebody comes in, they sit down with you, and you'll do a basic diagnosis. But a diagnosis will just target one particular area. So what I'm hearing you say, and please stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, but what I'm hearing you say is you've got to have the diagnosis to target one particular symptom, but there's also another diagnosis that has to happen that covers a completely different area. And between the two is what you put together and be able to work the treatment out.
That is correct.
Okay, we're on the same page now. All right, now when did you discover this?
Oh, right from the beginning. It became very clear that people in addiction have other problems, major problems, some of them minor problems, but that the other problems will never be addressed. Not only were they not addressed, but they were the reasons for their addiction.
Okay, so in essence, let's say I had a problem, I came to you, and it was an addiction problem. And you just, as a therapist, you just worked on that addiction problem. Without looking at the other side of it, the other diagnosis, that means that what you were addressing, you could handle part of that. But I'd always have that underlying problem, which would cause me to come right back to the problem I had in the first place and never really be able to get through with it and come out of it.
You said it very nicely. I wish I could say it as nice as you did.
Okay, now, how many, and I think this is a fair question, how many therapists really understand the dynamic and the strength of the dual diagnosis?
Unfortunately, not many. Unfortunately, there is a split between addiction counseling and psychotherapy. A patient may see both, but there is going to be no connection between them.
Okay, now we hear constantly behavioral therapy, and obviously behavioral therapy, a tremendous amount of behavior comes from repetition of action, or you get a particular experience. The experience creates an emotion. The emotion will allow you to protect yourself, and that creates that behavior that we deal with. But it's got to a point now where this isn't something that's going to be as effective as people thought it was years ago. What do we do to compensate here?
That is true. We have progressed in our understanding of what works and what not works. Now, in the addiction field, we're a little lagging behind. We are still using more behavioral therapy than any other type of therapy in order to treat the symptoms of addiction rather than the causes of addiction.
Okay, now, when we find cause, is there any kind of an overarching theme? Is there a common denominator? And when I say common denominator, is there something that you have found over the years that's actually the base cause of addiction that seems to run rampant with the majority of the people that you work with?
Yes and no. There is a common denominator, and there is also specific that would be to each individual. The common denominator would be that there is a dysfunction in the way that they are functioning brain-wise. There are two players in the brain that are the main significant players in this scenario, are the limbic system and the frontal cortex. As a child, I only have the limbic system to go by. My frontal cortex is not developed yet. It's starting to develop somewhere between the age 10 to 12, and it continues to develop all the way to age 22 and sometimes 25. Normally, during this period, people or human beings transfer from using the limbic system or the pain and pleasure principle to using the frontal cortex when they do high-order evaluations. If you have
Let me hold you up. We don't want to lose anybody. Let me say that in a different way. The limbic system is your emotional system, and that's what we're born with. That's naturally. When we start to transfer to that frontal cortex, then we get into your reason, your logic, your willpower, etc. So it's that transition period that I'm hearing you say where the problem is. We go from an emotional mind to a logical mind, and sometimes the transition is not the easiest to take on. Am I close here?
Yes, you are very, very close.
What are we missing?
That is correct. There is something that happened during that transition period that did not allow the person to move from using the limbic system or the emotional sectory, if we may say so, to using the frontal cortex where the higher order functioning is of making good choices based on values, based on what would be constructive, and so on. They continue.
Logic.
If you don't make this transition, you continue to make your choices based on pain and pleasure.
Now, by the way, let's go a step farther with this. When you're dealing with the frontal cortex, when you're dealing with logic, etc., I think when it really comes down to it, when we go beyond our ability to use logic, we move into that limbic system. We move into that pain or pleasure, which triggers that fight or flight mechanism that's going to cause us to stand up and fight, lay down, play dead till the danger's over, or run away. So, in essence, and stop me again if I'm wrong here, that what we're saying. Go ahead.
Yes. That depends. There are several dynamics in the brain. And the connection between the limbic system and the frontal cortex is major in all of them. But, for example, when you talk about depression, you talk about the connection between the neurons. When you talk about anxiety, it's basically not always, but it can be the imbalance, not between chemicals between neurons, but between the two hemispheres of the brain. When you talk about anger, when you talk about explosions, we call it bipolar, it doesn't matter. We are talking about wrong interpretation of some kind of an experience that make me feel like there is a threat to my life, and then my alarm goes off. When my alarm goes off, the limbic system, instead of sending the messages to the sensory motor part, which is at the top of the head, it sends the message to the back of the head, which is the fight and flight mechanism.
Yeah, okay, and then at that stage of the game, you're not thinking, you're just reacting in responding.
Right. So depends on what is your diagnosis, depends on what dynamics in the brain we will be discussing.
Okay, so what we are dealing with then, and again, I'm going to paraphrase, a dual diagnosis is a diagnosis for the emotional part of your brain and the diagnosis for the logical part of your brain. And if you've got the diagnosis of the two, then you can work with whatever both problems are. If you only do one and you leave the other one out, you leave somebody with the same problems.
Yeah. The main problem is a problem of interpretation and generalization. Yeah. The limbic system receives information from the outside through the senses. But when information comes in, the limbic system doesn't know what it is. If I may give you an analogy,
please.
Imagine that you had a black bag, and in the black bag there would be items. And I would tell you, put your hand in there, feel an item, and tell me what it is. When you put your hand inside, you can tell that you are touching something, but you cannot tell what it is. That is what happened in the limbic system when information comes in. It doesn't know how to feel about it because it doesn't know what it is. So it sends a message to the frontal cortex above others. Tell me what is it, and you give the item an interpretation. Once you give the item an interpretation, it knows what kind of a feeling to generate or to attach to it. And that's the part that you have control over. You can always change the interpretation. And that's where cognitive therapy comes to play.
Okay, now there was something also you talked about in the cognitive therapy, the eye movement desensitization and the reprogramming. That subfield that you talked about, that cycles of sleep, there's basically three, but that first cycle of sleep is the eyes moving back and forth. And that in and of itself allows you to be very open to suggestion.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you very well, but I'm assuming that you're asking about EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprogramming, which is, as you said correctly, is a segment of cognitive therapy because it rewires the brain. EMDR is the new kid on the block, so to speak. We don't quite know how it works yet, but I have been using it for a little over a year now, and it works very well. It primarily used in order to reduce pain from trauma in the past that you're still carrying today. And I happen to have not something that you do with the eyes, but two electrodes that you hold one in each hand, but it works just the same. The idea is to have bilateral stimulations of two sides of the brain, and that appears to be very healing. Somebody did some kind of CAT scans of the brain to show how white lines forms at the top of the head. I haven't seen them, but I believe that they exist. The bilateral stimulation doesn't have to be with the eyes. It can be with anything. Sometimes we tell somebody who is angry or feeling pain, go and take a walk. And that seems to relax because it's a bilateral stimulation, one leg after the other. You can also snap your fingers one after the other or tap something one bilaterally, and that would work too.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time now. Let me ask you this. Is there a website that we can find you at to get more information?
Absolutely. My website is ronitclements.org.
Ronit.clemens.org. Ronit, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've really appreciated your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
You're gonna miss me, baby. Some of these days you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're gonna get it. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Call us anytime to join in. Toll-free number is 1-888-429-5471. That's 1-888-429-5471. John Satin, Chris Pate with us. They're the authors of, listen to it very closely, it is Living an Inspired, Empowered, and Joy-Filled Life, 365 Daily Tips to Get You There. And John is a life, relationship, and a business coach. His passion to assist people to live fully and happy lives led him into the field of personal coaching and business consulting. Chris is BBA, is a life, relationship, and business coach. His guidance and wisdom and intuition have provided life-changing experiences for thousands of people around the world. Guys, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.
Great to be
here. Oh, you guys are really coming in clear. You're on Skype. I love every second of this.
Yes, absolutely.
We are.
It's like we're in the same room. Let me ask you this, and John, let me throw it to you. When we talk about living an inspired, empowered, and a joy-filled life, have you found in all of the work that you've done, and even the work that you've done together, have you found a common denominator, an overarching theme that causes somebody to get blocked, not to be able to reach out and grab what's out there that they can have?
Absolutely, Michael. That's a great question, first of all. What I have found over the years, and we've coached thousands of people over the last decade, and the common denominator that Chris and I have found is that people have simply put up blocks and barriers because they seem to be looking in the wrong places. It's like they're going into areas outside of themselves seeking happiness. And it's a never-ending cycle of seeking that really is the major block and barrier for people to create the life that they want and to be inspired.
Okay, Chris, let me ask you this. I come to you guys individually or together. If I don't know what happiness is, if I've never been able to grasp it, How do I look for it? How do I get the recognition that that something, that missing something in my life, what it looks like and feels like, so I know what it is when I finally get in front of it?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that, Michael, because so many people who do come to John and I have said that they do feel so numb. In their whole life, they felt so numb that they don't know what happiness is. And what John and I recommend to people at first to tap into that happiness is to accept the past, accept what is, and just allow yourself to take a few deep breaths, get out into nature, just relax and allow yourself to be. In other words, just to sit and be, and that can assist you with connecting with your happiness.
So, Chris, what I'm hearing you say basically is stop resisting yourself.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Just allow allow yourself and give yourself permission to be happy.
Oh, that's an interesting word. And John, let me throw it over to you, because it's permission. Most people look for someone else to give them permission. We're so wrapped up in wanting to be loved or respected or accepted by someone, we become at the mercy of what they think, what they feel, and their opinions. So how do you get somebody to transition to say it's okay that I give myself permission to be happy when they're so used to looking to someone else to get the permission?
Well, what this really stems from, Michael, is reputation. And the first thing that we suggest to people when we work with them and collaborate with them one-on-one is to give up the notion of having a perfect reputation. And Chris and I will always joke a lot of times with our clients, and we'll say, this isn't high school anymore, and you're not hanging out by the locker room or in the locker area and wondering if you're going to be asked out on a date, you know, by the football player or by the cheerleader.
Sure.
So it's giving up that perfect reputation and moving away from the importance of being liked by people. Give yourself permission to be respected by people. So it's moving away from being liked to being respected. And that's really the shift that we suggest people make.
And by the way, what I have found over the years, guys, is basically this. Not everybody is going to like you. And it doesn't matter what you do, not everybody is going to like you. And that we don't have to get into this, but most of it's projection, has nothing to do with you in the first place. And if we're trying to get everybody to like us, it dilutes who we are, and there's a lot of confusion there. The people who are going to like you are going to like you, and go with that.
We like to use the line, Michael, what you think of me is none of my business.
Who was that? That was,
I think Terry Cole Whitaker.
Terry Cole Whitaker. I interviewed her years and years ago. Didn't she write a book called that?
Yes, exactly.
And by the way,
you really have to think about that line and ponder that.
Yeah. And that's absolutely truly what it is. And people are searching, and I really believe that they don't know how to search. That's why I've got the book in front of me, by the way. I think you guys did a great job on it. We need to be held by the hand and say, take a look at this way, take that step this way, and on and on and on until we finally get it, whatever that means, and that we can do it for ourselves. The things that you're talking about is not something that they innately know how to do or what to look for, and it's very hard to find it taught anywhere in a public school setting.
Exactly.
Impossible to find at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, we would like to see that change someday.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would love to see you guys out of work. You hear what I'm saying? But if everybody was fixed, you wouldn't have any work. But I think the most important word that we have here, the way you guys have branded yourself, is the possibility coaches. And that's really what it is. Life is about possibility. And if you tell somebody they think it'd be free and happy, yeah, sure, it's not going to work that well. But if you give them the possibility and allow it to move one step at a time, all of a sudden things start to change.
That's correct, Michael, because possibilities open the door to opportunities. And that's what helps move people along their road to success and happiness.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now, John and I don't believe that slogan that possibility or opportunities only knock once in a lifetime. John and I know that opportunities are always knocking. We just have to be open to receiving them.
Oh, by the way, Chris, every 30 seconds, I think there's an opportunity. And you're right. You've got to be able to recognize them.
Mm-hmm. and feel deserving of receiving them and taking some inspired action towards them.
And there's another way to look at this also. A breakup of a relationship, the loss of a business, someone passing away, in and of itself is also an opportunity if you begin to realize the life lessons in all of this and then move on and you know, grow with it. But opportunity is a very powerful word, and it's recognizing that opportunity can come in very strange ways.
Michael, if I may just interject for a second about that, because I'd like to tell a little story that really hits home and is very personal, but I'm sure your listeners can relate to this. Opportunity knocks in every moment, and you talked about a loss of a loved one or ending of a relationship. Give you an example for me personally. 5 years ago, my father passed suddenly. And seemingly on paper, it's, you know, it's tragic. Anyone who's lost a parent, you know, we all have experienced it at one point in time, or we are going to experience it. But what happened for me was it became a magnificent opportunity because I was facing some challenges with my mother. It was a strained relationship. Ultimately, my father's passing sort of created this opening or an opportunity for me and my mother to heal, basically. And that's what's transpired over the last 5 years. So it turned out to create this magnificent relationship. And perhaps that opportunity, if that didn't occur the way it did, would have never happened.
And by the way, absolutely. And it's taking a look at that. Now, at the time it's happening, they're not fun to go through. I mean, there's no question about it. Yeah, but afterwards, that's really the key. Just to make it very fast, I probably told the story 1,000 times, but it's just a wonderful story to bring it home. There's a woman that I know that was wanted to be a professional athlete, and she was working with a coach in college, and the guy said, you don't have what it takes. She wouldn't believe him, so she went to another coach. And they worked together, and she became the professional athlete she wanted to, and she went on, and today she's a professor of athletics in one of the universities in Northern California. But to go backwards on the story now, the one coach says, you don't have what it takes, so she said, I'm going to go find somebody else. The guy that she found, guys, she ended up marrying him, and she's been married for 20 years now.
That's great. That's a great story, Michael.
Yeah, but it's, you never know. You never know. One of the things I want to bring up that I know you guys addressed that is just extremely important. I'm old school. You know, I've been around the planet for lots and lots of years. And when I was a kid, there was no such thing as the, you know, the iPhones and the Blackberries. And we didn't even have computers in those days. And I watch people today. They're sitting next to each other, texting each other. And we've lost, it seems as though we have lost that physical touch, that emotional touch, because you can't get that on a BlackBerry. And I think that's a major problem today when you ask somebody to get in touch with you emotionally and all they know is to type on a piece of machinery.
Yeah, I know. It's becoming more and more challenging. It seems like this day and age, the technology goes both ways. It's helpful, but it's also a hindrance. And it creates a lot of people that can be connected by the technology, but there's also so many more people that are lonely and feel so isolated in this day and age. And it's because people have lost that ability to reach out and have that face-to-face relationship. And some of the younger children, too, may lose the capability of having a conversation. So it's sad to see that may go. You know, but John and I, we're very optimistic about the future. We have a lot of hope for the young generation that there is a segment of them that will be going back to, you know, reconnecting again and having conversations.
I think what's a shame with the whole thing, I was 8 years old, my dad passed away. And I remember the morning that it happened. I was in bed and I could see into the living room and my mom was on the phone. Then they told her and she cried. And then she told my brother, who's 10 years older than I am. Now, I knew, but I didn't want to let her know that I know. Mm-hmm. So I went to school that day, and the teacher obviously saw something was wrong. So she brought me back into the coat room, and I started crying, and she put her arms around me, and she held me. Now, that's the best thing that could have happened to me. You do that today, guys, you can go to jail.
Yeah, it's turned around. There is a sadness to that, obviously, that you know, we can't reach out and physically touch someone. And there's also a disconnect with reaching out and touching people emotionally.
Yeah.
And when we're working a lot, especially when we work with couples, Michael, and even parents and children, we work with teens, we emphasize the importance of putting down the technology and getting back to basics. You know, Chris and I call it, you know, sitting around the dinner table once again.
Right.
I mean, yeah. you and I and Chris are basically in the same age group or pretty close thereabouts. And we grew up sitting at the dinner table every night. Well, that's virtually unheard of today. Virtually unheard of. I've spoken to so many people with children, with young children and teens who rarely sit at a dinner table.
So it is important to have that family time together, as John said, power down and just have some real family time.
Now, I remember when I was a kid that we ate every night together.
Yes.
And maybe Saturday nights we didn't, but Sundays always absolutely. Right. And we were a family. That's when it came out. That's when we talked. That's when we did whatever. And I think, guys, that's what's missing today is that I'm going to call it that acceptance, that feel of family. And that's where the, you know, an older generation got their identity from the family. You don't have that connection today. You don't get the acceptance today. They're going to go out, the kids especially, are going to go out and get their identity from someplace else. And sometimes those are not the greatest sources.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And also, if I may add, Michael, they're not going to even have a solid, good identity. What really happens with technology is it's really a symptom. Technology and the use of it, it's a symptom. It's an addictive symptom of our society. And it really what it is a dysfunction. It's a person's inability to communicate, to be open and vulnerable. And it's unfortunately, it's rampant in American society. And one of the things that Chris and I do when working with people is we assist them to be open and vulnerable and to deal with those blocks and barriers that basically are laced with fear. And it's always fear that prevents people from having a relationship.
You're very spot on with that. Let me make this quick analogy, and then we're starting to run out of time. What is an absolute shame, this is basically what happens today. The kid walks into the room. I'll do an extreme because this is not what happened today, but along these lines. Kid walks into the room and you say, "Kid, tell me the truth." And they're quiet. You say, "Tell me the truth." So they tell you the truth and you whack them for it. Okay. What did they learn? If I tell the truth, then I'm going to get hurt. Take that fast forward into politics today, and that's the exact same thing that you have. If someone tells you the truth, they're going to get smacked. I think that in and of itself is something that we have to move through and get over. It's so hard to be vulnerable. And by the way, you're right about being vulnerable. Yes. But it's so hard to be vulnerable for most people that are afraid if they are, they're going to get hit.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
That's exactly what happens. So people hide behind this mask of what they believe they want the world to see of them, and they're not being authentic anymore.
No, absolutely, and I got that loud and clear. Anyway, the name of the book is Living on the. What did you do? Oh, I got that. She's doing stuff over here. I got living an inspired, empowered, and joy-filled life. 365 day tips to get you there. Anyway, Radio Susie, she's on me all the time with this stuff. Without her, I'd be in trouble, but sometimes there's too much information. Guys, I want to thank you so much for being here. And the website is www.365, those are the numbers, dailytips.com. John, Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank
it's
you,
my
Michael.
Pleasure.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms singing for you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. You can pick up the phone, call us, join us anytime if you have a question for the guest, 1-888-429-5471. That's 1-888-429-5479. Tim Mann with us. He's a co-author of the e-book with Mark Victor Hansen and Brian Tracy, No Thanks, I'll Skip the Recession. He's a leading authority on helping businesses enhance their productivity and profitability by taking clients step by step from creating a clear plan of action to growing their business in today's economy. He successfully left the corporate world and with a shoestring budget started his business consulting firm, 9010 Consulting. Tim, hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about No Thanks, I'll Skip the Recession.
Wonderful. You know, by the way, let me ask you a question. And this is a good place to do it, a talk show. Let me ask you a question. I think the question really is, with all of your experience, everything you've done, the things that you do, define a recession. What is it? I think there's two definitions, and people get stuck on the wrong one. So when we talk recession, what are we talking about?
Recession to me is people that have lost their jobs, unemployed, people that are having problems financially, businesses are going under at a bigger rate than normally. There's no growth really happening in the economy. So those are the key components. And America's been hit hard here the last couple of years. America's down right now. People lost their jobs, people not knowing that they don't want to lose their job. People lost their homes, and we are right now on the biggest. We spent more money on welfare in the last couple of years, 2010, 2011, and 2012 budget, than we have in the history of welfare. And we are the greatest nation in the world here in America. And so it's been hit hard by this, what we call this recession. And I talk about No Thanks, I'll Skip the Recession, where you have the mindset of skipping the recession and moving forward with your life.
Let me throw something out, because I really believe recession, with most people, think it's a lot to do with money, but that's not it. I think you can have a mental recession, because when you take a look, Tim, look at the unemployment rate, 8 point something, whatever it is at this point. But there is also, if it's 8 point something, that means 90-some-odd% of the people out there are also employed. There is a tremendous amount of money still around. People are just a little bit close as far as letting it go. So there's a mental recession. If you believe all of it, if you become the victim of it, then you're going to fall right into place with everybody else. But I'm with you. I'll skip the recession. I'll skip the mental challenges that I create myself that tell me I can't go out and make it today.
Yes, and you make a great point about being the victim. If you're going to focus on that, and that's what's going to show up in your life. But if you really have I talk about with my clients, is having a clear plan of action. You really get crystal clear on what you want to do, visualize the way you want it to happen, and think positive. I work with what's called championship tools. And these tools dealing with about reframing your negative thoughts to positive thoughts and anchoring in positive emotions each day, and also visualizing what you want in life. And if you use these tools, they will help you and propel you into the near future of having what you want.
And by the way, one of the things that you lead people with is, and it's the psychology of performance. Performance is a psychology, it's a biology, and there's chemistry behind it also. It doesn't just happen.
Yes, it doesn't. It's a matter of, it's our bodies are actually, it's like we have energy and it's vibrating. And some of the richest people in the world and some of our founders really knew about these technologies that we had inside us, and they didn't want to tell anybody. But now it's coming out in the forefront in today's society, where like visualization and reframing thoughts and thinking positive, and this whole thing about law of attraction is really attracting things into your life. And I really believe in into this, and I've used it throughout my sales career and my business career, and it's really helped me achieve extraordinary things.
No, by the way, I've had Mark Victor Hansen. I've also had Brian Tracy on. Brian's been on over the years 3, 4, 5 times, and I remember when I had Mark Victor Hansen on. Now, this was way back. I'm thinking this was after they did the Secret, the Law of Attraction, and then they reestablished it, and then they did it all over again with all, you know, more books, etc. And it was a very interesting thing that that Hansen said. He said that they got to a point, they talked about the Law of Attraction, but Tim, they didn't tell anybody how to do it. So to redo the whole thing and, you know, out want the books and the seminars and the workshops. And I think that in and of itself is the key. We need to be brought through step by step. I don't care how sophisticated someone is. There's always an area of whatever they're dealing with that they don't see. And you have to look at it through somebody else's eyes to bring whatever that invisible something is up to the table, and you can see it. Once you can see it, you can work with it. But if you can't see it, you can't work with it.
Exactly. And what you're saying is that you really need to work on this, and it's not something you just do once or twice. And I find a lot of people will do this for about 2 weeks, and then they'll quit. Why is that, Michael? It's because we want instant gratification. We want things now. We've been trained through this through marketing and through our lives on having instant gratification. So it's a matter, it's something you have to do, and you have to practice it and be consistent. Consistency is the key to this, and really practice it and really find the steps and the tools. These tools will work for you.
Yeah. And by the way, one of your talking points, and I know it's an extremely important talking point, the survey, and I'm not sure which one that was, that 80% of businesses are looking for ways to improve their results. And one of the major reasons, Tim, I think, for that today is that marketing has completely changed. With the advent of the internet, I can sit down and Google anything I want. I can negotiate almost anything I want, make the buy, have it delivered to the house, never leave my desk. So there's got to be a way to get out there and compete against that. And when they're talking about different ways to improve the results, results have to do with knowing your target audience and knowing how to communicate with that audience in such a way they hear whatever it is that you're offering is going to be that something for them that's going to fix whatever problem that they're working on.
Yes. And that's great that we have this type of economy now where we can just sit at our desk and buy whatever we want and research wherever we want, and things are moving a lot faster. And what you're saying is also that you really have to hone in and see how your ideal client eats, drinks, and sleeps, what they're doing every day. I have a client that's a chiropractor, and he was targeting to the wrong audience. Now we're looking at different ways where we could target him to a better audience, that really more affluent audience that could understand his product and pay him the right type of money that he's looking for to accomplish in his business.
By the way, with chiropractics, a great story, true story of the very close friend of mine is a swimmer. He's in Southern California. He gets out there every morning and he swims in the ocean. All right. And he would get into races and he'd miss the buoy. And by doing that, he'd have to go back and touch it and do whatever they do, but he kept losing races. So he took his wife, who was having some back problems, to the chiropractor. And as he's talking to the chiropractor, he says, I've been having this trouble. I'm swimming. He was just creating the, topic of conversation. And the chiropractor says, if you align your spine, that's what's causing you to be off. And one thing led to the other, and Dean got a, you know, he got an adjustment, and it cleaned up the spine, and then he went from buoy to buoy to buoy, began to win races. But the key was this. It wasn't Dean's story. It was the chiropractor. The chiropractor got it and got it loud and clear after Dean talked to him. He became, you know, the swimming chiropractor of Southern California beaches, whatever. He found his niche market, something that everybody else wasn't thinking about.
Yes, it's about really differentiating yourself and being uncommon than what everyone else is doing. I also have a client that's a dentist, and he was just doing the general thing, giving the discounts of having customers come in. He wasn't just a general family dentist. And I took a look at him, and I noticed that he's very gentle with his clients, his customers, his patients. And I decided, let's focus on being the gentle touch dentist. And this just hit home. So all his marketing deals with the gentle touch dentist, because what everyone goes to the dentist for is they're in pain and they fear the dentist. But if you have a gentle touch dentist, then that fear will go away.
Yeah, but that was interesting. Just a quick aside, they did a survey years and years and years ago, and the highest suicide rate in all of the professional medical field were dentists. Who likes dentists? They hated them.
Yes. I heard that same statistic.
Yeah, years ago. You know, who would think? But I think it's very important today with what you're talking about, because businesses today, they're crunched, they're time crunched. They got to do a lot less, in a lot less time, and end up with a profit at the end of the day. So it's called, how do you do that? You do it through somebody who's been there, done that, work with people, and then you get that foundation from where they make their decisions, and you take a look at that and you make your changes there. Now they get the foundation to go out and work and to do whatever they need to do. And I think, and stop me if I'm wrong, but I think the first step is not externally, it's internally. It's the clients that you have now are the ones that are going to keep that base of income flowing in. And there are so many people out there in business that they're out looking for new clients, they're getting competitive, and they're forgetting the ones they have.
Yes. With that, Michael, it's about referrals. And your current clients are your best referral source. If you've done a great job, if you've done a lousy job, then forget it. But if you've done a great job, then that's your best referral source, because they already know you, they like you, they trust you, they know what kind of job you're going to do. So it's a matter of gently and marketing to your current clients about referring new customers, their friends and family and new customers back to you. And I do this with my clients. Is I set up referral programs where we work together, and where it's tuned into them, where they see the new clients coming in are coming from the referral sources.
Yeah, absolutely, no question about it. Because really, when it comes down to it, Tim, I really believe and have believed for so many years now that the most powerful marketing out there, bar none, is and will always be, is word of mouth. And that's really the key. One person telling another person telling another person. You know, you expand that to social networking, you got, you know, millions of people out there. But it's the same thing. It's the referral source. It is so extremely important. And maybe you can work that referral source in such a way that everybody gets compensated. Now you got the incentive to go. And one of the other things is the people that work in that particular place, whatever it is, whatever business it is, they have to feel vested. And when I say vested, not a profit percentage, but they have to feel a bit of ownership. Ownership in the way that they've participated and what they've added to the business is extremely important, and they're acknowledged for it.
Yes, it's almost like you're part of the business, as you're saying.
Yeah, so no question at all.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. I picked the book up page by page, and I read it cover by cover. I'll skip the recession. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get to walk away with after I've read the book?
Well, first, you're going to have a positive, you're going to start changing your mindset and start having a positive frame of mind and get rid of this whole idea that there's this bad recession going on and things are not working your way. And you're going to get some tips and strategies to use in your daily life to help you get past this, what we call the recession. So it's about saying to yourself, no thanks, I'll skip the recession. What I talk about in my section of it is the championship tools, which are four of them. One is reframing your negative thoughts to positive thoughts, and then anchoring in positive emotions. We are bombarded by negative emotions all day long. We don't even know it. And it's a matter of having those positive emotions, because we make great decisions when we're feeling good, and we don't make very good decisions when we're not feeling so good. And the third one is visualizing and really having a plan of action with that visualization and sitting there for about 5 minutes, 10 minutes a day and visualizing the day, your ideal day, visualizing what you want to accomplish in your life, visualize the things you want to have as regards to monies, cars, homes, relationships. And the fourth one is breathing. Now, why did I bring up the word breathing is because we do everything for everyone else, but we really don't take care of ourselves, and it's about taking care of yourself first. And with breathing, it changes your state, your being, instantaneously. And I share a little bit about breathing exercises. So No Thanks, I'll Skip Through a Session is a great little book, ebook. You could download it free off my internet site, 9010consulting.com, 9010consulting.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Tim, we're just about ready to close it down for the night, but I want to thank you so much for joining us. Again, it's an ebook, www.9010, those are the numbers, consulting.com. Hey, Tim, man, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, thanks so much, and I just wanted to give a shout-out to you for going out on the airwaves. You've been doing this for, what, 3 decades now and making a positive impact on the world, and we need more people like you in the world. Thanks so much.
Hey, Tim, and thank you so much. Good night.
All right. Take care.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Once upon a time.
I like the last energy better. This is Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk. I'm Dresser After Dark. R.H. Townsend with us is a certified legal investigator, former two-term national director of the National Association of Legal Investigators, is a seasoned veteran of more than 50 years of field investigation, adjusting catastrophic personal injury, civil litigation, and is well-skilled in the 11th hour trial support. He's a former U.S. Marine, having served with the NIS assigned to criminal investigations. That's black market sales of U.S. goods by military personnel purchased through the base military commissioner in the Orient. Now semi-retired, Townsend has become a pro se litigant and consumer advocate for those that wish to be represent themselves in litigation to right the civil wrongs and damage infliction upon them by corporations. I almost didn't get that one out, but I got the words. Robert, I welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. Very glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Let me start it this way. Semper Fi.
Semper Fi. Absolutely.
Me too. Okay. Now, by the way, when we talk about pro se litigation representing yourself, most people are frightened to death of that. You know, there's a court case, and the word on the street, basically, Robert, is that if you go in by yourself, you're going to get totally eaten alive by the professionals there. It sounds as though that's not necessarily true if you know what you're doing and you have the ammunition walking in.
That's correct. The idea of being a vexatious litigant takes a matter of time to understand the procedure. In a court of law, sometimes the procedure is more important than the facts, more important than your presentation. It is knowing the procedure and being prepared before you see that judge. And to get prepared, there are a number of tutorials on the Internet for pro se litigants, many of which we're reviewing and will ultimately put on our site. But when you have a case or an injury, when you're ripped off and you go to an attorney about it and he says, whoa, wait a minute, I don't have any interest in this case, it generally means that there's an insignificant amount of money involved or an insufficient amount of money involved for him to undertake the case. But he'll go ahead and represent you if you're willing to give him an unconscionable retainer.
Sure.
Most people prefer not to. Most people prefer to go into court and represent themselves, but I caution them. Do not go in unless you understand the procedure.
Absolutely, Robert. That's one of the most important the important things that got said that I've heard probably in the last 5 years or so as regards to any kind of a civil litigation, criminal litigation, whatever the case may be. Most people will get eaten alive if they walk in and are unprepared and have no idea how the process and the procedure works.
Exactly. And the judges are complicit in this with the attorneys. One has to remember, and let me preface this by saying that in my experience, most judges try to be fair. However, when you come in as a pro se,
yeah,
they want to pull their hair out. Because you do not understand the step-by-step procedures. And as a result, you make a number of motions, or you take it personally, or you think the judge has not ruled in your favor because he doesn't like you. And in some cases, that's correct. But those are issues that you have to deal with in any way, in any part of life. The one thing you don't want to be classified as is a vexatious litigant. You want to protect your access to the court, and that is the very reason many of our young people over the years have gone out and done battle and have died in order to protect one of your most precious rights, and that right is to redress in a court of law when you've been wronged.
Okay, Robert, let me ask you this. When was it for you, and I got your background here, it's strong. When was it for you that you realized this and started to work on it, started to create what you created?
You put forward my credentials very well, and I appreciate that very much. However, even with my experience, when I brought my first lawsuit in pro se, I was overwhelmed. I did not know the procedure. I wasn't prepared to deal with the issues. And when I went in front of the judges, the opposition took easy advantage of me. It was only when I got away from the issue, stepped back, and took the time to learn the procedure, was I able to then come back and start resolving my cases as they should be resolved and gaining some respect from the opposition and from the judges. And that's the one thing you want to get. You want to get the judge's respect. You want to go in and you want to say, Your Honor, I've taken the time to learn your rules, and I'm here to abide by those rules to present my cause. And pro se litigation, that's pro-se-litigation.com, is forming a network nationwide of attorneys and litigation support personnel, educational materials, and what have you, so that Joe Sixpack can log in and learn those procedures and get guidance from licensed attorneys and support personnel, such as certified paralegals and that type of thing, so that they're fully prepped when they go in to deal with the court.
Robert, by the way, what I'm hearing here, and stop me if I'm wrong, a very powerful message, and it's the difference between procedure versus the law.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Remember,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, remember, the elite legal community are the legal elite and the judges are part of a large fraternity. There are huge fees and revenue to be earned. So if you go into that playing field, you better be prepared to deal with that because they're going to protect their own. It happens in every field.
Sure.
And they do not want the pro se to come into that field. So they'll do everything, absolutely everything, to discourage you from doing that. And if discouraging you fails, they'll declare you vexatious, and then you are in a world of hurt.
Okay, well, now that's I want to bring that up. I want to stop you there. When you said vexatious, that's the first time I've heard that word as it relates to a vexatious litigant. What are we talking about now?
We're talking about a pro se that goes before a court several times, perhaps, and irritates a judge or the opposition, but more likely the judge, and the judge will then issue a what they call sua sponte. That means on the judge's own motion. For an order to show cause, meaning that you have to come in and show the judge why you should not be deemed a vexatious litigant. Now, if the judge issues that sua sponte order, I suspect you're going to be declared vexatious. And once you're declared vexatious, your rights to the court have been taken away, perhaps for a lifetime, unless you get a pre-filing order from the very same judge that declared you vexatious, and you meet a bond, which the very same judge establishes at his whim. You can't go to federal court because federal court will say, hey, you haven't exhausted all of your resources, and you haven't exhausted all of the avenues of attack in the state court, so you have to go back to the state court. Well, here's the circle. You go back to the state court, and they say, whoa, wait a minute, we can't accept that lawsuit until you file your pre-filing order, and we approve it, and then you post this bond. And bonds can be very, very costly, usually collateral up to and including 100% of the amount of the bond.
All right, so effectively, what we're dealing with is getting in and understanding procedure. If you understand procedure, then you can move your way through. If you do not understand procedure, you're going to step on some toes. They're going to have to work more than they normally would. You're going to be deemed vexatious, and you're stuck.
Yes. And you may be stuck for a lifetime. Once you're put on the vexatious litigation list, you can apply to have that label lifted once a year, and only once a year. And guess what? You have to go back before the judge that declared you vexatious to have him lift the label of vexatiousness, and I suggest to you that's not likely to happen.
Okay, so in essence, knowing what we could be up against, and effectively, again, knowing ahead of time, we sidestep it so we don't run into that problem, because if we don't know what we're doing and they do label us, we're in trouble for almost ever, and there's no way to get out of it, and we're stuck. And the original intent going in gets lost in translation somehow.
Exactly. Justice, our ideal that you and I grew up with in this country about our justice system, the balancing scales, the lady with a blindfold and a sword in her hand is a myth. It's simply a myth. It does not exist. And you have to go in well-armed. You're in, when you file your lawsuit, you're at war. I don't care if that lawsuit is for $10,000 or $5,000 or $5 million. You're at war. And it does not matter.
And you better have the weapons to be able to deal with going to war. I mean, there's no question about that. And, you know, the old adage, do not take a knife to a gunfight. It's not going to work.
And that's exactly what you're doing if you're not prepared. Now, the vexatious litigant statutes are so one-sided, they do not apply to attorneys. They only apply to the pro se litigant. And I'm starting a petition in California in support of my action for declaratory relief to have the label affixed to me lifted and to have the what we call in California the CCP 391.7 vexatious litigation statute modified so that it is fair, so you're on an even playing ground. Now, there's a very good reason that there's a vexatious litigant statute. It was originally enacted so that pro se litigants would not continuously harass our elected officials for the decisions they made. They would bring lawsuits for frivolous issues, but they're not that dramatic. They're not that many. The California Vexatious Litigation Statute has been in effect for better than 40 years. We file 1.4 million cases a year in California in Superior Civil Court. And would you believe in all those years, some 68 million cases have been filed, and only 77 people are on the vexatious litigant list? I submit that the pro se litigant is not the problem. I submit that attorneys bringing frivolous lawsuits may be more of the issue than the pro se litigant.
By the way, I think that today is more prevalent than it was 35 years ago. I mean, today, if you sneeze, somebody's going to sue you. And it's gotten way out of hand. I mean, it's gotten to the point, Robert, that it's totally ridiculous at this stage of the game. And the court system in and of itself, I don't think they can't even define the rule of law because it's not the same all over the country.
That's correct. And as importantly, they're blaming the wrong people for the problem. The problem is not the pro se litigant. Our frivolous litigation by the pro se litigant. Sure, there's going to be a few, but it's not everybody, yet they intend and are trying to maneuver you as a pro se litigant into a position where you're going to be declared a vexatious litigant. CCP 391.7 in California says you have to have 5 cases in 7 years totally resolved against you before you can be declared a vexatious litigant. But they don't play by that rule.
Just out of curiosity, if you were to ask most attorneys what a vexatious litigant is, what would they even know?
Yes.
Okay.
They love that statute because it doesn't apply to them. The judges love that statute because it doesn't apply to anyone other than a pro se litigant. And the image is reinforced when the pro se litigant goes into the courtroom and is not prepared. He drafts a poor pleading. He makes motions that are non-meritorious and things like that. And that does not need to happen. Today, with prosalitigation.com and what have you, the pro se litigant can be fully prepared to go into a courtroom and represent themselves reasonably well. Remember, we're not talking about a major personal injury case, catastrophic or what have you. We're talking about being ripped off by your bank on overdraft charges. We're talking about debt collectors that harass you. We're talking about people such as herbal supplemental companies on the internet that sell you certain products that are supposed to perform a certain service, and when it doesn't and you go to get your money back, they refuse to give it back to you. Now, on an individual basis, these are seemingly small sums. But it's a matter of corporate policy today, unlike when you and I grew up, to rip people off.
No, I got it. By the way, Robert, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this very quickly. I know somebody that got into an auto accident, did not do anything about it. It wasn't her fault. And she got sued by the insurance company because she was driving somebody else's car. They decided they weren't going to cover her. And there was a judgment against her. Now they want to take her driver's license away. Now, would that fall into the area of what you do?
Oh, gosh, no. That is far too complex. She does need an attorney. Remember, what we do is not practice law. What we do is handle situations where people need some fundamental guidance to get through the system. But when you're talking about personal injuries of that magnitude, when you're talking about an insurance company policy dispute, good heavens, we do not practice law.
That's the time. You don't do it on your own.
No,
it's called
you don't.
An attorney.
If you have,
go ahead.
Right. Let's say you have a Honda vehicle, and there's a class action, as recently happened, against Honda, and the participants in the lawsuit or the class get pennies, and the attorneys walk off with millions, and you choose to opt out and go in and be paid properly. That's the type of case you want to pursue.
No, I hear you. Now we're about out of time. I noticed you're in Southern California, Orange County?
Yes.
Okay, now you're close to a place that's very dear to my heart. Were you an officer or enlisted?
No, I was enlisted.
Okay, then you'll appreciate what I'm going to say. We won't tell anybody the date here, okay? But June 21st, 1960, I'm standing tall at MCRD in San Diego. So did you go through... Did you go there? Or
I certainly
or
did. No, I went through MCR Platoon 2001, Sergeant Smith, DR.
Yeah. I got it loud and clear. I was there in 1960, 17 years old and rocking. Okay. By the way,
you better believe it.
Yeah, it's been great to talk to you. Please, can we get your website?
Yes, pro-say-litigation.com. That's
wonderful.
Pro-
Go ahead.
Say litigation.com.
Wonderful. And if anybody missed it, it'll be up on our website. Okay, Semper Fi, and thank you so much for being on with us.
And thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
So many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sandra Kornblatt with us. She is the author of A Better Brain at Any Age and Brain Fitness for Women. She's a health writer and developer of the Restful Insomnia Program, which helps people rest when they can't get sleep. Again, she's the author of, let me say it slow, A Better Brain at Any Age and Restful Insomnia. And let us say, Sandra, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, there was a question that can be asked, and people would take it lightly, but my goodness, there's so much more to this question underneath than really meets the eye. And really, the question is, you know, should women take better care of their brain? And when we hear something like that, most people wouldn't take this serious, but it's a very serious question, isn't it?
I think it's a serious question, and I think that it really affects women's lives, and that you're right, they don't realize it. I think that women generally, instead of thinking about caring for their brain, they beat themselves up for not their brain not functioning better. So if a woman forgets a name or misses an appointment, instead of trying to figure out what they can do, the woman thinks, oh, it's my fault, I should have done something better. But treating the brain with compassion and the self with compassion, you can really start to make a difference in how you respond to the world through your brain.
Well, sure. And the other side of that is there's a tremendous amount of brain chemistry, and there's a lot of research being done and more information coming out of how the brain actually affects you intellectually, emotionally, physically, your behavior. I mean, this list goes on and on. And when we really think about it, when we talk about food, in essence, by the time that you eat something, it turns into a chemical. And that chemical runs through your body, goes to the place it's supposed to allow you to function. So what we eat has a lot to do with how our brain is going to function.
You're absolutely right. And I think that is some of the issue that we have with fat, because a lot of the fats that we eat, if we don't, the brain communicates and is the function is fat. So if we eat a fat that has a different structure, the neurons can't communicate well. But if we eat fat, like in fish, the brain sucks it up and starts to communicate better. Plus, yeah, you know, there's, you know, vitamin D and a lot of other pieces to eating healthy that not only affect the body, but really do affect the brain.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And you know, the people, they refrain from working out today, keeping themselves in some kind of addition to this obesity problem that we have. It's running rampant. And realistically, exercise in and of itself allows you to, you know, your body to circulate, digestion, everything else. It clears the brain. And there's so many things that people just take for granted or won't do that can be so good for them.
That's true. And, you know, I have a problem with the word exercise. It's a useful word, and I use it. But to me, exercise feels like somebody pointing their finger at me, telling me what I should do. And when that happens, I'll be damned if I'm going to do it. So it puts, you know, I do end up doing it, and I do feel great afterwards. But I think the word gets in the way of people really feeling who they are and feeling their body. So the word I like to use better is moving intensely. Because, you know, if you ever hear somebody saying, I'm going to go ride a bike or I'm going to go for a walk, there's usually a lot more joy in their voice than when they say, I'm going to go exercise. And that's the piece, I think, that, you know, there's a connection there and beyond the shoulds, because shoulds only get you so far in life. And having compassion and joy in moving really makes a difference.
Go ahead.
Moving is incredible for the brain. Beyond the runner's high, there's also the brain also starts to put out BDNF, which you don't have to worry about the initials. It means brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And that is basically Miracle-Gro for the brain. Because what it does is it helps all the dendrites, which are the little ends to the neurons, communication ends, helps them grow. So that when you exercise, you can learn better. They've done millions of studies that, you know, the way that you think, the way that you react to things increases after you exercise. It's pretty amazing. Yeah.
Sure. Another way to say that is we have an internal communication system. and it happens to be the chemicals, etc. But the one part of the body communicates with the other part of the body, and it allows you to function. If there is if there's a disconnect, if there's an interruption in that connection, then that's when we have problems. And if you're doing what you're talking about doing, you know, exercise, eating right, the other thing obviously is the connection with people that also you talk about, you know, for the brain. It releases certain chemicals. Dopamine, great chemical, the feel-good stuff. And if you see somebody, you like somebody, you're talking, you're having a good time, you feel good, you release a chemical, and it's very healthy.
It is great. And communicating is actually a very helpful thing to stave off the effects of Alzheimer's. But if you think about it, communicating is not so simple because you have to notice where you are, the body language of who you're talking to, the atmosphere, what you want to say, if they've heard what you said. And having a conversation does, you know, it uses the brain, and the brain likes it. The brain likes to be used.
And now, by the way,
I was going to say, by the way,
we've heard time and again that there's a difference between a man's brain and a woman's brain. In all of your experience, is there any truth to that?
Well, I tell you, I'm not an anatomist, so I've not cut open a skull. So I can only tell you what I've researched. But
sure.
What I have found is that even though there's been a lot of hoopla about the differences in brains, the physical part of the brains, the men's brains and women's brains, are basically the same. There are some parts that are different sizes, but and I think that hormones do affect the brain, but they're still really, there's a lot of research that's been put out that, for instance, they said that because a woman's anterior cingulate is bigger, she worries more. Well, the anterior cingulate also means that you think and you perceive more. So it's not only the research, but it's the spin that gets put on the research. So I think that there's a whole lot that we do know, you know, that there are some differences in the brains and that hormones affect the brains and the flow of hormones affects it, but there is an incredible amount we don't know. And what's good about what we don't know is we get to appreciate the mystery of the brain and the mystery of our lives so that we can look at having a lot of options instead of feeling boxed in to a corner in terms of what tells us our brains can do.
I learned something a couple of years ago on the show, which is very interesting. What's the difference between the way women experience things and the way men experience things? And it has to do with, I'll never forget this, the guest said it, and I thought, you know, I got it. That's true. That the girls, quote unquote, the youngsters, the little ones, they get lap time that the boys don't get. They get hugged where the boys don't get hugged. And you actually use a different part of the brain when you're dealing with those kind of emotions that the young boys really don't get, which causes the pattern that creates the behavior. And it all has to do with the way that the part of the brain that's used and comes to the forefront. And that lap time really hit me, and it hit home. And I thought, you know, that's got to be a really decent answer.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. They also look at even prenatal sexism, and I just use that term just in terms of making sex differences between the men and women.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, men say that they're proud of having a son and they're excited about having a girl. So, you know, a lot of what is being researched and found, it's really hard to separate from what you're saying, the lap time or what people say that boys and girls can do. You know, you start to believe it.
Yeah.
And that affects your brain as well.
And if anybody really wants to know how the brain works, and we've all gone through this from one time to another, Sandra, you remember a time when you walked into a room and you saw somebody and instantly they didn't even have to say that you didn't like them, okay? And then there was a time you walk into a room and you see somebody, you immediately like them. Whatever that unconscious connection is, whatever it be, it releases a chemical. And it's the difference between releasing adrenaline or dopamine, whatever the case may be, is how you're going to feel. And it happens to us constantly. We are totally in control of the chemicals that are being used at the time. Now, you can reverse the entire thing by doing what you're talking about, having a base understanding of it, and then you control it.
Right. You know, I mean, I can't necessarily control all the chemicals that go through my brain, but I can certainly make sure my brain has an abundance of the kind of chemicals I like. So,
okay,
you know, fish oil will help me be more relaxed when you're tense. There's some lovely chemicals, adrenaline, that'll go through your brain that will make your day just horrible. But if you, you know, if you use what you eat, if you use exercise, what you think, how you perceive yourself in the world, all of those things affect the chemicals. And it's a mystery. It's a miracle that we have under our skull. And the fact that we can be aware of it is also another miracle.
By the way, Sandra, I think we just said the same thing in a different way. And if we're aware of it, if we begin to understand it, then we're not at its mercy. We become in control of it. Because when you begin to understand it, then you have something called choice. You can choose to be upset, scream and yell, do whatever the case may be, or realize that you don't have to go through those things.
Right. And I would agree with you, and I would say that for me, it's not necessarily we don't get to control it. We get to interact with it. We have a lot more choices about how we relate to it.
Yeah, better way to say it, yeah.
Yeah.
No, absolutely, no question about it. And I really believe that this is information that it's geared towards women. But so a lot of women, it's not that they don't know, it's they don't know that they don't know. And that's really where the key is. You get information up like this, and they begin to recognize some of the problems that they've had, and what they've been doing is not working. Too many people get stressful, they try this, they try that, and nothing works, and they're back to square one again, and where do they go? And a lot of it really starts inside. It's not anything you can take outside to put in. It's what's going on inside. And getting a handle on understanding it is your first step to being able to control it.
Right. And the point of my book really comes from compassion for the brain, compassion for the stress women's brains are under between information overload. I don't know how many emails you get when you come back from vacation, which everybody in the Western world who has a computer is affected by, but women also have a whole lot of expectations, what I call expectation overload, in terms of looking good and managing their money and taking care of their babies and reading to their kids and taking care of their elder parents. There's a lot of stress on women. And again, when women recognize that, just like you were saying, they can start to have some compassion for themselves and for their poor brains that are working so hard. And then they have a different relationship to forgetting a name, forgetting an appointment. Instead of, you know, beating themselves up, I should be different. It's kind of like, oh, I wish I had done that differently, but that's not, it's not me. It's the world and how I'm interacting with the world. And then I also think with compassion, you can then do the tips and hints with a whole different frame of mind. You can start to do things that are going to make you feel better because you have a relationship to who you are and your brain that's a unit. You know you want to feel good rather than somebody telling you you should do it. And then you end up making changes more.
Sure. By the way, Sandra, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at, website where we can buy the book at.
Well, the book is available everywhere. So your local bookstores and your independent stores to Amazon and Powell's and Barnes & Noble. And where people can get more information is the website brainfitnessforwomen.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, Sandra, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I enjoyed it. It was great to talk to you.
Great. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtain's fallen, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more.